Welcome to the 37th Floor, the Pitt Honors podcast, where we talk about undergraduate student research, scholarship, and creative projects here at Pitt, from history and philosophy to better understanding how our bodies fight disease.
In the inaugural season of our podcast, we talk with current Pitt students and Pitt alum who have received prestigious national scholarships for their work.
My name's Brett Say, Director of Research and Creative Programs, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Josh Cannon, scholar mentor here in the Honors College. Hi, Josh. We're going to be talking with one of our own today.
Yeah, our good friend and colleague, Monica Morante.
Mm-hmm. So Monica was an undergraduate student here at Pitt, but also works with us in the Honors College now and applied for a Fulbright. So Josh, would you tell us a little bit more about Monica and the Fulbright?
Yeah. So yeah, as you said, Brett, she's a Pitt Honors alumna. And she graduated with a Bachelor's of Philosophy, which I think one of these days we'll probably be doing a podcast on that. But if you're not aware of the BPhil or Bachelor's of Philosophy, I highly recommend you check out the Honors College's webpage about it. Excellent, excellent program. Really good way to get research experience in as an undergraduate and to get a degree that reflects that research that you did.
Josh, you have a BPhil, right?
I do. I do. Yeah. So I am biased, clearly, in my description of this. Monica majored in anthropology and she minored in classics, and her BPhil was on Athenian ceramics, as I recall. So a classical pottery, essentially.
Yeah.
My dissertation was on a late Bronze Age pottery, so I connect with this in many different ways. She won her Fulbright scholarship to teach English in Malaysia, which is not at all related to Athenian pottery.
No, but definitely a cool experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
So the Fulbright kind of essentially has, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it has multiple different components that you can apply to. So you may have heard of the Fulbright, you know, somebody might say, oh, they were a Fulbright scholar. But the program itself has different kind of branches to it. You can go and teach English abroad in a particular country like Monica did. There's also a research stem that you can do, or you can go and do research abroad in a particular country. Maybe those are the only two stems. Is that right? Am I missing a branch on the tree?
Well, there's kind of the research one is often lumped together with grad school. So you can you can also do a graduate program. In a foreign, you use the Fulbright to pay for a one-year graduate program in a foreign country.
Right. But these are, you know, countries throughout the world. It's not a small list of countries. It's a pretty big list.
It's anywhere where the U.S. has an embassy and the threat level is acceptable for students to travel there.
Sure. Yeah. So I think it was fun to talk with Monica because, like you said, Josh, this wasn't related to her kind of research and scholarship that she did as an undergraduate. This was a new experience, and she used this Fulbright opportunity to do something completely new and interesting, which I think we don't think of as much whenever we think of applying to scholarships.
Yeah, really, I guess, envelope pushing for her, so to speak, or just getting out of, you said it better, getting a new experience. I think that her perspective on the experience is really wise because she had, honestly, as she'll talk about, she had a mixed experience. There are highs and lows. And I think that her reflection on that is really valuable to hear, because while we encourage people that want to do a Fulbright to do it, and we think that there's a lot of great experiences and opportunities to have with a Fulbright, it's nice to hear a more grounded perspective, and also obviously a perspective of someone who's actually done it. I didn't do it. It's nice to hear a grounded perspective say it is pretty exciting, but there are also some challenges. There are also some obstacles to overcome while you're having this experience. And I think Monica addresses those really, really nicely. And let me just give a little bit more about the Fulbright before we dive in. It's over 140 countries that are available. It is open to college seniors and graduates and graduate students. So really the cutoff for this version of Fulbright, there's a lot of different Fulbright funding. So this version that we're talking about, anybody who doesn't have a PhD, anyone who does have a bachelor's degree and does not have a PhD can apply. Mm-hmm. It was founded in 1946, and the goal of the program is to develop intercultural competence in among American citizens while also promoting cultural diplomacy and relationships between America and other nations. So you'll see some similarity with this in the Marshall. Obviously, the Marshall is focused on Great Britain, but the Marshall is looking to improve relations between America and Great Britain. Well, Fulbright, likewise, is looking to improve relationships between America and one of these 140 countries, 140 plus countries that you can go to. You can apply through Pitt's Honors College. So this is similar to what we talked about in the Boren podcast. You can apply through the Honors College, which enables you to get a Pitt endorsement, but you are not required to. You can apply for the Fulbright on your own. I think that would be unwise. There's no disadvantage to applying to the Honors College, and there are numerous advantages. The Honors College runs workshops for the scholarship over the summer. Alicia Green is a scholar mentor who manages those and is your point of contact for Fulbright. Initial campus applications are due to the Honors College at the end of August each year, and the national deadline tends to be early October, I believe.
Yeah, so I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, but with the Fulbright, since you're eligible to apply essentially after you graduate, if you're a student here at Pitt who's graduated, we'll still work with you, right? We'll still help you. You can come back to us. So just because you've graduated doesn't mean that we won't work with you. We're happy to work with you.
Yeah, the only instances where we can't work with you is if you're currently enrolled, perhaps for grad school, in a different institution.
Yeah.
In which case, it's that institution that needs to help you. Right. We're less able to help you in those situations. But there's actually a neat story that Leisha and I heard when we were at a conference about scholarships 2 years ago. And it was a 50-year-old farmer. I forget from what, let's just say from like Idaho. I don't remember what state he was from. But a 50-year-old farmer applied to do a Fulbright to somewhere in Central Europe. I don't remember exactly where. Maybe Hungary. I don't know why that stuck in my head, but to study farming in Hungary. And just, I mean, I don't know if it was a whim. I don't know where this came from, but that struck me as like a really cool example of, if you have a bachelor's degree, go for it. If you're a 50-year-old farmer who's run your farm for 25 years or what have you, and you want to take a break, you want to see how they're doing it somewhere else, you can apply for a Fulbright.
Also, Fulbrights are great for students who are thinking about taking a gap year.
Yeah.
I think no matter what you're planning on doing, that's a great way to fill that gap year with a really meaningful experience. So I think on that note, do you want to go talk with Monica?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's talk with Monica. Hello, Monica. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to talk a little bit about your Fulbright experience and just kind of how you got into research in general. So that's probably a good place for us to start. Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you got into research in the first place?
Yeah, for sure. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. So I got my undergraduate degree in anthropology because I thought it was a really great blend of kind of learning about everything, you know. I thought there was an element of, you know, learning about humanity and how could that not bleed into everything. So with that, I kind of tried to explore different aspects of this, and I found quickly that one of the ways to dive deeper was through research, and that was just primarily through all of the research articles that we had to do for class. And I didn't know anything about it in any way, so I ended up going to one of my professors and asking, so this research thing, how does that exactly work? And then of course they put me on like the gruntiest grunt level of doing research work, basically like trying to figure out how library searches worked and how I could, you know, get them the books that they needed. And then that was kind of where it started for me. And then I found that as I got a better understanding of how all of the searching was done and how it was centered around a main question, I could then develop that myself and actually pick something that I was interested in as opposed to just being a grunt. But for sure, that most basic level of contribution has been really, really informative and has been a way that I've found myself involved in projects over the years. So honestly, just offering to volunteer some time, some free labor, and getting a really great understanding of the background of other people's questions has been really helpful.
Who was the professor that you started to work with?
It was Dr. I don't know if they're still at Pitt. They're in anthropology, Dr. Strathern and Dr. Stewart. They've been here for a while, so if they're not still working, they're definitely emeritus.
I want to say Strathern. Strathern's still on the website. Stewart, okay. I don't know, but yeah.
Okay, they were married, so I don't know everything there, but.
So that's interesting. It seems like there are different ways to get into research, as we're learning from the different people who we're talking about, but yours was purely kind of that inquisitive way. You know, you got interested in something, you went to a professor, you talked to them, and as you said, you got kind of on this grunt level, and that could be a good place to kind of start learning the ropes a little bit. But then if we're talking about the Fulbright, you have a lot of different directions that you can go as far as where you take your research. What made you gravitate towards trying to apply to the Fulbright scholarship?
Yeah, so when I was applying, it was a different honors college than it is now. And so there are a lot of things that you guys are doing that I think is really great. So like some of the introduction to research, not necessarily having to start at that like grunt level, you know, and kind of getting into the more interesting things quickly, I think is really great for students. And as far as the Fulbright goes, there's two halves to it. There's like teaching English, and then there's also the coming up with your own project and implementing it in a different country. I went for the first one for the ETA position because I wasn't entirely sure of a question. I didn't have a big goal yet. Because I had spent so much time in anthropology and reading about ethnographies and knowing that cultural immersion was really necessary for the field, I wanted a chance to try it myself and figure out if it was something that I wanted to continue in my future whenever I did have an important question, and just try to see if it was a good fit. So, and it was a member, it was one of those things where I came in for a meeting with an honors college person for one thing, and then I ended up having a meeting with a different person for another thing, and then all of a sudden I was applying to a country that I didn't know really much about. but it was nice that somebody was able to, you know, see that potential in me and see that I was a good fit for something and encourage me to do it.
I was going to add, I'm glad you brought that up about picking the country. I was wondering if Strathern had anything to do with your choice of the Philippines, because I know that couple worked in South Asia and a little bit in Southeast Asia, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was their focus. They actually led a study abroad in New Zealand. I don't know if that's still running, but I was like the first cohort to go on it, and it was really cool. And so prior to arriving to New Zealand, I was familiar with the Pacific, because we had also gone to Samoa and the Cook Islands as well. So, and then earlier that, before I actually applied to Malaysia, I had spent like a couple weeks in China for the Pitt TU program. And so with my understanding of, you know, the Pacific region, and then also having some experience in China, I thought Southeast Asia would be a really interesting blend of the two. And that's why I went for Malaysia.
Oh, sorry, I got that wrong with the Philippines.
So yeah, I think that's a good segue into, we've been talking a lot with people on this podcast about the application process, but we haven't talked too much about what the fellowship is actually like. So you mentioned that you went for the ETA position. Could you explain to people a little bit what that position is, and then, you know, talk a little bit about the experience you had once you were able to receive that award?
So the ETA is an English teaching assistant. You are meant to be in the class and assist the teachers as a native speaker. And that can take a variety of forms. So one thing that they particularly want you to do is to run these camps. So it could be a day long, it could be a weekend, it could be a week, but you essentially come up with a grant proposal and a project proposal for what you want this camp to be. And because you're just going to be speaking English the whole time, you can kind of make it about whatever topic you want. So for instance, you could make it like survivor themed and have a lot of like really fun games with the kids, or you could do a leadership camp. and talk about some bigger things, also about like project management and design, and hopefully the kids will leave not only with like more confidence in their English, but maybe new friendships, a different set of skills as well. So we are supposed to kind of bridge that gap of what, you know, the West is in a lot of ways too. There's a lot of being a cultural ambassador that's also expected of you, which is also a really interesting balance as you come to appreciate, you know, their culture for what it is and kind of the political position that you're in as well. Because even though you're there as a person, like trying to learn and better yourself and understand the people you're with, there are a lot of things tied to that experience that you weren't necessarily aware that you were carrying in with you. So you end up learning so much during the entire experience. And then would you remind me of the second half of your question, Brett?
I think that was pretty much it. I think you got most of it. We're just talking a little bit about your experience over there. I would say, when you say you prepared a proposal for a program, you had to do that for the Fulbright application. So were you going in to this, you know, not really knowing who exactly you were going to be working with? You just had this idea. And how did that work out for you?
So there were two halves to the application when I did it, which was your personal statement, and then also kind of a proposal. And it was just kind of saying what you would want to do while you were there, how you planned on being involved, how you planned on being that cultural ambassador, and then also how you planned on being an effective teacher. So you could kind of go about it any other way. I talked about some of my interests and things that I was skilled at and things that I was interested in bringing with me and showing to the kids as well. And I think there are a lot of ways that people can go about that, either by doing something very, very formal. But I definitely took like a many paths approach and being like, well, we could do music lessons, or I could help them learn volleyball, or I could, you know, trying to incorporate a lot of activities into it, just trying to show some diversity in myself as a person and showing how that could apply to many different situations there.
I think that's probably helpful too, especially if you're essentially proposing curriculum for a group of students that you don't know yet, in a situation that you don't know what resources you're going to have or anything like that. That's really interesting.
Thanks.
So what advice would you give, I think, to students who are considering this fellowship, or even if you just want to talk about fellowships in general, however you want to frame that, what advice would you give for them as far as preparing for this and maybe even preparing for a potential award?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to disclose that I was an alternate. I did not get it right away. I was mm-hmm. like...
A lot of people are. That's also good. Yeah, that's good to remind people of too.
Yeah, yeah. So, and ultimately, whenever you're applying for these things, it's one of many paths to kind of trying to figure out what you want or trying to get what you want. So usually whenever people are applying for fellowships, maybe they're also applying for grad school or like year-long programs or who knows what else. And so while the more that I worked on my Fulbright application, the more that I realized I wanted it, which is also dangerous because if you come into something wishy-washy and then all of a sudden you spend so much time and effort and energy putting yourself into it, you realize that you want it. So I think you need to be prepared for, you know, what are you going to do if you actually get it? Because if you have so many routes to choose from, and sometimes the decisions make themselves for you, you know, whether or not you get the program you're applying for. But I think the most important thing is just kind of trying to stay aloof from all of it. Things are going to play out how they're going to play out. You have no idea if your reviewer that day is going to wake up and spill their coffee on themselves, and then it's 9 a.m. and the first thing that they read on a Monday is your application. You have no idea. So there's a lot of discovery, I think, that goes into applying for the whole process in general. That is not to be put aside from whether or not you did or did not get it. So I think that's my biggest piece of advice.
That's really good advice, because there is a pretty tremendous amount of subjectivity with these reviewers, with the process of deciding who's going to win or not. And I've unfortunately seen, luckily it's been a minority, but I've seen really good students not win awards, and there's kind of no rhyme or reason to it. It's just, it's you know, it happens in a black box. These reviewers and some other part of the country making these decisions, and all you can do is, you know, put together the best application that you have and keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah. And then also having other things, I think, as well, mm-hmm. kind of softens that blow, and you're not like completely left, you know, oh, I have nothing to do now, because yeah. that's not true. If you're as skilled as you are, you know, trying to apply for something like this, there's so much you can do with all the work that you've just done.
Yeah, that's good advice. Josh, is it time for the research roundup?
I think we can start getting crazy now.
All right, let's do it. Monica, the research roundup is kind of our lightning round, if you will, of questions, where we want to ask you a few questions, and Josh and I will go back and forth, and we just want to have your kind of like initial immediate thoughts on some of these questions. Sound good?
Okay.
All right, here goes. If you could suggest one class or opportunity for a student to take advantage of at Pitt, what would it be?
I think whatever your equivalent of underwater basket weaving is, I think you should do it. I took a class called Pots and People with Dr. Allen in anthropology, where you make like experimental pottery. And then we like ended up going to her house and like having chili. And it was one of the most exciting like classes I ever took at Pitt. I don't think it's still happening because she retired. But I know that there are other ones out there that are also like very unique and creative. I think there's one about like bookmaking, and then there's another one that's about like the score, like movie scores and movies. And that's also super cool. So definitely take something like very far out there for you.
Cool.
Yeah. I worked with Dr. Allen, and she's still around, but you're right, she's retired. Highly recommend. Dr. Kathy Allen of the anthropology department. What's a time when you felt like you didn't know what you were doing, and how did you overcome that?
How do I not say all the time? I think Malaysia was a really good example. I felt like I didn't know what I was doing there all the time, because the system for like personal evaluation was just totally gone. I had no idea if I was doing a good job or if I was connecting with people or anything like that. And I think that happens anytime you go into a new environment, right? So then you're kind of left to yourself being like, did I do my best? Was it appropriate for the situation? And how do I go about that? So I think just having some internal reflection of being like, did I try my best in this situation? Can I like give myself the benefit of the doubt here? And then just kind of, you know, let it go and move on from there.
I think that's great advice. No matter whether you're on a Fulbright or you're just starting a new internship or something, you're going to have those feelings. So in this hypothetical scenario, Josh and I have a blank check for you. And we say, Monica, we think that the work you've done is really cool, and we know you have a lot of potential, and we'd like to give you this blank check to do research on whatever you'd like to do. What do you do?
So many options. First of all, I would love the idea of a blank check. If you want to give me one of those for real, I'm into it. Let's see. I think I would fund my own PhD research and look into community resilience initiatives, artistic community resilience initiatives after natural disasters. I think that's like what I want to go for at the end of the day. I don't know how I'll get there, but that's exactly what I want to do.
So kind of how art can help heal communities in times of tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And then figure out how you measure that.
Yeah.
That's really specific. I mean, mm-hmm. that type of specificity will make that happen,
mm-hmm.
right? Exactly. Like you're gonna. I'm pretty confident you're gonna find that chance in some way or another. Okay, our final question: is there anything that you would like to plug? Any person, program, event? Anything that you think we should our massive audience should know about?
Oh my goodness. I've been thinking about this for a while, ever since I saw the questions. And I think what I'm going to plug is the fact that if you download the Goodreads app, first of all, make a Goodreads account, mm-hmm. download the Goodreads app, and then also download the Carnegie Libby app. And with those two together, you can just be requesting all of your ebooks or any book you want, and you never have to worry about finding a book, because anytime that you need to, that you need a new book, you can just reference right there, and you don't have to spend like those like 30 minutes that you spend on Netflix, like scrolling through, finding something to watch. It's really up to my book game. And I think that might be good advice because it can apply to anything that anybody's interested. So hopefully expanding the accessibility of everybody's knowledge.
It is indeed universal advice.
I have the Libby app. I don't have the Goodreads app, so I'll have to download that, but I have the Libby app and it is amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to add an impromptu last research roundup question to the whole group. With that Libby app, there's lots of online audiobooks that you can download. If you listen to an audiobook, do you tell people that you've read that book?
Yes.
I do too.
I do.
Yeah, I mean, either you're reading it with a voice inside of your head or somebody's voice outside of your head, but like mm-hmm. I have no problem with that. You would pass a test on that book the same as somebody who read it.
True.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, also, thanks for validating me. Yeah.
Goodreads doesn't have a listen to button. They have a read button, and that is nice. What I click.
Well, Monica, thanks so much for being with us here today and telling us a little bit about your experience and sharing your advice. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Take care.